That's Segundo here. I have spent the past few days sighing audibly. But nobody has paid attention. Which makes one wonder why Richard Russo would write a 600-page book on the subject. After all, if I were to transcribe all the sighs I've let loose, I'm sure it would amount to about 600 pages, if not more. So why does Russo get a fair pass? He even wins Pulitzer Prizes for these mammoth books. They're too big for me to read. Perhaps it's because, as our young roving correspondent learned, the man really likes to laugh. As for me, I've been unable to laugh since 1998, and the only reason I was laughing was because I accidentally ingested ether.
Okay, so I'm here with Richard Russo, who's the author of Straight Man, Empire Falls, and most recently, Ridge of Sighs. Richard, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Ed. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. We had a little adventure here. First off, I actually wanted to go ahead and talk with you about how the two-narrative structure came to be. It consists of two narratives. You have one told in the first person by Lucy, and the other in the third person, largely consisting of Noonan's story. And I'm wondering, you mentioned in another interview that you had difficulty with the ending of this book. I was wondering, did this third-person narrative kind of come midway through writing the book, or how did this kind of come to be?
Yeah, I had enormous problems with the ending because the structure wasn't right. I had envisioned, actually, that I was going to tell all of Lucy's story first, and then I was going to move on to Noonan's. At some point in the book, I had written about 600 pages of it, and about 400 or so of those pages had been Lucy's. Yeah. I told most of Lucy's present time story when he's about 60 years old. And then I let him tell the story of his childhood and his friendship with Bobby Marconi. And I got very nearly to the end of that, where Sarah, the girl that they're both in love with, is introduced. And then I went to Noonan in Venice. And then I told all of Noonan's story in time present, 60 years old, painter living in Venice. And then I got him to the point where he's thinking about Sarah, because he begins a painting of Sarah, which gets him thinking about Sarah and Lucy. And then I had him tell his story of their past. And then I started Sarah telling her story. And there was no end in sight to any of this. And I gave that 600 pages or so to my agent and said, I think I'm working on three novels here. He said, no, it's one. He said, it's one novel, but you just need to get all of these stories, time present, time past, the three different characters, you got to get them all started at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's once I had the structure, once I realized what I was building and how I might be building it, then an ending presented itself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's almost as if there are these two strips of land, mm-hmm. so to speak, these two sort of periods of times. I mean, the Bridge of Sighs could hypothetically sort of connect them. I mean,
That's right.
Was Byron very much on the mind when this came to mind? Or what was it?
It was either that or Death in Venice. And it seemed that the latter seemed to be much more the likely scenario.
Absolutely. I mean, but in terms of leaving this particular period, you know, without giving too much away of the book, relatively open to interpretation. I mean, for example, Lucy boasts about how his encyclopedic memory, his encyclopedic memory, and yet there are certain sort of details of his life, such as David, that kind of come into fruition later, I guess. So what steps did you, I mean, in fact, there's actually a number of things, I'll just throw a whole bunch of things at you at once, so my apologies, but I mean, the fact that characters approach Lucy and often are at his elbow, I find to be a very sort of interesting sort of touch on your part, as well as the fact that he has these spells. When did you know that he was kind of, I guess, operating with these blinders on, or did this kind of come when you sort of knew that there was this kind of, you know, these two strips of land locked by this bridge?
I knew about Lucy's fundamental unreliability almost from the start. Yeah. From the first time I had him speak to the reader in the first person, it's one of the reasons I chose the first person, because I think if a character is a little off-center in some way, if he has some blind spots, first person is the way to get at those. Just let him reveal himself and fail to reveal himself. Because in Lucy's case, it's not that he's lying to us, it's just that he doesn't always know the truth. And if he does tell us less than the truth, the motive is always love. You know, he loves his wife, he adores his father. He can't bear to tell a story that would embarrass either of them. And so there are these blind spots. And that was part of the fun of the book, was making that bridge between Lucy and Noonan, allowing Noonan to tell some of the same story, and then later Sarah too to tell some of the same story. And when those stories don't exactly parallel, they don't exactly connect.
Yeah.
Then some wonderful friction takes place in which you the reader become involved. And you say, wait a second, that's not exactly what Lucy told us here.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And when Sarah says at some point, you know, you told the story of that day we were on the staircase, we were coming up to the dance and our eyes met. Why did you write that it was some other girl? Why didn't and he doesn't know, because he's completely blocked that out, that was Sarah on the staircase.
Yeah. There's one interesting thing also I wanted to ask you about, and that is Marconi, the name. I mean, you have Marconi actually being of Italian and
right.
Irish ancestry, and
right.
that was also the same ancestry that Marconi, the inventor of the radio telegraph.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, that cannot be an accident. And also there's the whole macaroni salad that forms the sort of great successful
right.
side dish.
That's right.
So I have to ask you about why macaroni and Marconi was on the mind.
Yeah. I don't know why it was. I wanted Big Lou to be able to make a kind of stupid joke
yeah.
about his name. And I was also interested right from the start of all, there are all sorts of mirrors in mirror images in the book. And I wanted the Marconi marriage to be the opposite of the Lynch marriage, because they're both mixed marriages. They're one half Irish and one half Italian,
yeah.
but it's the other half,
yeah.
you know? And so I knew I was going to be playing with that, and also with the way in American society, at least in upstate New York where I grew up, after the Second World War, where the Irish and the Italians gauged their progress in terms of the American dream by each other. I mean, that was certainly true in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
So I was playing with all of those things. I didn't have the inventor of the radio in mind particularly, but I was dealing with the other stuff, the Irish and Italian stuff and the mirroring and all of that.
Yeah. Because it actually absolutely matches up.
Yeah,
that's the
yeah.
thing that's funny about
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
The Spinarkle sisters who live underneath the Marconis. This seemed to me a sort of interesting. I mean, without giving too much away in the book, there's
yeah.
a sort of subsummation of some kind, in the sense that we have these people who are so isolated in a weird way from
mm-hmm.
the rest of the town, and it's almost as if the natural forces of the town come to sort of collect upon this. And the fact that the Marconis live above them seemed to me a very sort of specific vertical kind of stature of some sort, that they are somehow, they have more gravitas, I suppose,
yeah.
than the sisters who we find out have been living quite a secret life. And I'm wondering, in terms of some of these hidden niches, were these of as much of importance in terms of developing this town as well as...
Well, the architecture of the town is very important right from the start.
Yeah.
You know, West End, East End, separated
sure.
literally by Division
yeah.
Street.
Yeah.
And the isolation of people within a community is certainly part of the story, and the way that people secretly move about within the structure, within the architecture, because you have Buddy Nert living above the Lynch family but sneaking down into the store at night
yeah.
through a secret door.
Yeah.
And you have the Spinarkle sisters living their secret. But you also have the black people living on the hill, which is a little niche within the larger niche of the West End.
Yeah.
And very isolated. Again, living very isolated lives. And you have fences all over the place. You have
yeah.
Gabriel Mock, the little black man who the town doesn't have enough money to maintain the first aristocratic hall built on the outskirts of town, but they do have money to maintain a fence.
Yeah.
And so you have Gabriel Mock on one side of the painting, one side of the fence, and Lucy, his friend, Gabriel befriends Lucy, and they paint opposite sides of this black fence, a black man on one side of the fence
yeah.
and a white boy on the other side, shades of Mark Twain.
Yeah.
On the other side. So I think it's the architecture of this novel, the way in which it's set up with its various boundaries, and the stream that kind of bisects the West End. So you've got in one sense a very tight society of all different kinds of people, divided according to race, gender, sexuality, class, all of those things, but there, but all these boundaries are set up, and people are finding their way around the boundaries.
Yeah.
And Lucy marvels at the fact that junior high school actually encourages that. They go to those dances, and when the lights go down, and in the theater too, people are switching seats.
Yeah.
And it becomes very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, even like the dances where you have these various wraiths, as Lucy describes them, kind of, and then he finally realizes near the end of the book, oh my God, these people have not been able to pay. That's what their motivation for coming late into the game is.
Yeah.
So I suppose this division is something of, I guess, just to some degree, a conceit to the reader, because it's sort of like you're kind of saying, well, the division street, that is as regular and as absolutely rudimentary a metaphor to some degree as almost anything else. So so is there a certain, I mean, is this kind of what causes the book to have its complexity and its depth, this notion of like maybe some of the symbolism of these dichotomies, and even the river, which reflects the shimmering dyes from the tannery that's reflecting of the artistic world that we sort of see, and the gray lines that are too much black in Lucy's drawing. Where was I going with this?
I'm with you. I'm
trying to talk to you here, as a matter of fact. No, maybe we could talk about sort of how these dichotomies play in with these larger complexities of economies, of sociologies. Are these sorts of hidden nooks where people kind of come in to steal from the store, so to speak?
Well, I mean, one of the nice things about complexity, if it works, if it's not just structure without meaning, the nice thing about complexity, and especially a complex structure, is that I think it will allow readers to read the book the first time through and kind of acknowledge the complexity and maybe hopefully enjoy it. But I think it allows readers to come back a second and third time and investigate those little nooks and crannies where things are buried and perhaps derive pleasure from a second reading, and kind of the way you think of the complex novels that you like to go back to for second and third reads. I always think of Dickens in that respect, because the Dickens novels are always labyrinthine in that way. And one of the reasons I loved having Venice in this book is that Venice is a labyrinth as well. You think of Dickens, you think of the Melville of Moby Dick. And those are books that, because of their structure, too, the structure adds to the enjoyment of the book. I don't know, maybe I'm overanalyzing my own work, but it does. But the structure of this novel, its complexity, was part of the joy of writing the book, and also I have to say part of the enormous difficulty of writing the book too. It just took forever to get all the ducks to line up facing the same way.
Well, I mean, what steps did you take? I mean, I know that you handwrite in diners and the like.
Yeah.
This has to be, of course, clearly an arduous process, but I'm wondering exactly, since you're talking about, like, this probably may be the most ambitious of all of your books, in the sense that this is just an entire world encapsulated in economy and sociology and the like. Did you have a pretty clear idea going along, or is it a matter of just wading through here and figuring out how this town was sort of set up?
Well, the basics of how the town was set up I kind of knew, but the other stuff, I mean, thank God for computers. I always say thank God for writing tablets and pens, because that's the way I like to work. But past a certain point, thank God for computers too, because you can take whole blocks and move them around and see how they work.
Yeah.
If where you put them originally doesn't work quite so well, you can yank something out, a block of material, and put it someplace else and read it through in that context and see what it does, how it resonates in a place that's different from the place that you ultimately put it. And in that respect, too, my work over the last decade or so in writing screenplays was helpful, too, because that happens almost invariably in screenplays when you're working with a director who says, well, wait a second, do we know this at the right time? What would happen if we, instead of learning it here, what would happen if you learn it over there? And you kind of don't know until you take that block, you take that scene, you move it over to another place. And then you read through it and you say, well, wait a second, that makes the story more shallow. Or sometimes you say, actually, that makes the story more deep. If this character doesn't know this at this time and doesn't learn it until later, that makes the scene play differently. And in some sense, it's better not to know than it is to know. And so there was a lot of that in this book, of discovering that Lucy, we're better off for Lucy not to know this now, or we're better off for Noonan not to know this now, or we're better off for Sarah to learn this at a later point. Or sometimes, you know, we got to get this right up in the front of the book. And so you take that block and you move it, and it's fine. You discover you discover that it actually works there. But thank God for computers.
Yeah. Well, there's also, in terms of, like, the mirrors as well, I mean, we're talking about all these characters, a lot of them have a tendency to flee the town. And,
yeah.
And flee, without, again, giving anything away, flee the country of where they're from. I mean, and it's almost as if, were you sort of trying to kind of keep these characters in the town as you were writing?
Well, that was one of the things about the way I'd originally structured the book, was that they were fleeing. You know, I loved them. I followed them. I knew what they were. I knew what they were up to. I knew why they interested me. I knew what they had going on with each other, but they all kind of just... they all kind of lit out for the territories, and they got to the horizon and waved goodbye. And that was, so there was a, structurally, there had to, I had to set up some boundaries that would keep them from just disappearing off my radar.
Sure, sure. I'm wondering, what research did you do for the market that they actually set up? Did you do a lot of talking around, or did you talk to people who set up markets during that particular time period of, like, the post-war America?
No, I did exactly none of that. But one of the nice things about looking at things through the wrong end of the telescope, or in this, the right end of the telescope, is that I was able to look at what happened, or just witness in my own lifetime, what happened, the difference between a corner market and a convenience store. So that I was able to make Tessa look really smart. She was the person who, after her husband buys this seemingly doomed corner market at a time when, I mean, he's already lost his job when milk went from bottles to cartons and from trucks to supermarkets. So he's already, in a way, been the victim of a changing America. And then what does he invest in? He invests in the next domino to fall, really. Yeah. The corner market is being replaced by supermarkets. But I, you know, looking at this from the year 2000, it was 2003 when I started working on this book, or 2002, I was able to look at what happened, why the phenomenon of the corner market actually became something fairly successful in the convenience store.
Yeah.
And by looking at it from the year 2000, I was able to create a character, a very smart woman who's able, by recognizing that this is going to happen, and by saying, no, we're going to set up the store in such and such a way so that all the things that people need are going to be at the back of the store. They have to walk past everything they don't need. And then on the way out, we're going to put a few items near the cash register that are going to be expensive. They're not going to go to the store for those things, but they're going to be convenient for them there, and they're going to pick them on the way out. Something so that we're going to take advantage of psychology.
Yeah.
That's basically what happened with convenience stores. And then, of course, they were all rescued by the lottery.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have to do much research. I've just been watching this happen. But then you get to make this one character look brilliant for coming up with a series of schemes that are convenient schemes at a time before those things had happened yet.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, is this the way to just keep a character going, having schemes? I was talking about this with another author who I was pointing out the fact that he featured a lot of schemes in his book, and it sort of provided this surprising heft to the actual narrative, in the sense that, oh, well, this book feels as if it's been sort of lived in, walked in, and thoroughly sort of researched. I mean, so this may be the sort of secret here. You know?
Looking at the things through the wrong end of the telescope.
This is
its own kind of historical novel.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember when Richard Ford's second novel in that trilogy, not The Lay of the Land,
Independence Day, that
won the prize. I remember, because my wife is in real estate, I remember reading that book just dumbstruck at how well Ford seemed to have lived in the world of real estate, despite the fact that I don't think he's ever been a realtor, and he certainly wasn't married to a realtor, at least I don't think he was. But not just the way the system worked, but the philosophy behind it, I was dumbstruck by that, how brilliantly he evoked that entire world and how he seemed to know it. But when you go back and look at it, There are a few things that he knows really well, and he's probably, and I don't know whether he was looking at it as I was through the wrong end of the telescope or not, but it was very convincing.
Yeah, you've alluded now many times to that passage at the end of that chapter, which I would describe sort of as the American pastoral moment. I mean, I'm very curious as to how that kind of came to be, that the doors and through the wrong end of the...
I'm sorry, which...
The three paragraphs where you have him describing about all the doors that are open at youth and then not open.
Oh, right.
Yeah, we're talking about through the wrong end of the telescope. And
yeah,
so
yeah,
I'm
yeah.
curious as to where that particular moment, which seems to me your American pastoral moment, came from, exactly, how that came to be laid down.
You know, it's funny, that particular metaphor of doors, of walking through doors and hearing doors close behind you and then having fewer doors to walk through and choose between, was the metaphor that I used to use when I was teaching to describe how plot works.
Interesting.
When I was teaching my undergraduate and especially my graduate students, plot is a very difficult. They say, how do you come up with a story? How do you know what happens first, what happens next, all of that? And I was trying to explain to them that the best stories, the best plots, are the ones that end up kind of paradoxically. You want to be surprised, but after the surprise, you want a sense of inevitability, like that's the only place the story could have gone. Those two things, that's why a lot of books are disappointing, because that's a very hard effect to achieve. How can you surprise somebody, even as, after they register the surprise, they say, oh, of course, this is the only way it can go. This is the only way it could have gone. Those two things are antithetical, and yet the best books always have that, you know, that coming together. So I was always looking for a metaphor to explain that to people, to my students. And I'd say, all right, you think of it this way. You got 1,000 doors. You choose one. You walk through it. Now you got 500 doors. You walk through that. You got 250 doors. Every time I started explaining that to students, that there were fewer and fewer doors, that was going to provide the inevitability, but there was still the surprise. You didn't know, every time a character makes a decision, it seems like there were so many other possibilities. So it's a series of surprises that ends up with a sense of inevitability. But as I explained that to my students, and as I was writing this book, it occurred to me that that's also a description of life and destiny.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I had lectured my students, and then that lecture provided actually a metaphor for this, the most complex of my novels.
Wow. And this, so I guess the more representative a book is of life, the more you can, I guess, grapple on to teaching metaphors, the sort of things. Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. I actually wanted to ask you, and this is something I've been wanting to ask you for a long time about, and this goes back to Straight Man, the up-talking, the question marks. We actually see this a little bit with Nan Beverly in this book. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me because your dialogue is often very straightforward, very naturalistic, and yet you can't resist the question mark sometimes. So I have to ask you about that. Do you feel that the question mark is just one of those punctuational sort of ideas that you can have fun with?
Yeah, it's fun. It's liberating. It's indicative of a certain kind of character, especially a certain kind of female character.
Yeah.
We notice that, I think, as a sociological point, that young women in school and in the academy, even when they're certain about something, will very often state a certainty, or something that they feel fairly strongly about, a certainty that still comes out in the form of a question. There's that lilting upturn at the end that seems to be it seems connected to gender in some way. I'm not the first person, certainly the only person to notice this. But as a result of that, it can indicate in either gender, I think, a kind of uncertainty that's grounded in. It can be grounded in gender, but it can also be grounded in other kinds of uncertainties. I think I do it with Lucy, for instance, more than Noonan, because Noonan is such a straight-on, in-your-face guy.
Yeah.
Even when he's not right, he's seldom in doubt. And, you know, so you don't do that with that kind of character. But you can do it with a character who has more uncertainty, whether it's, you know, regardless of the source of that uncertainty.
Another question I had, and it's something I was curious to ask you. This book reminded me very much of John P. Marquand's The Late George Apley, because...
Oh, I haven't read that.
You haven't read
No.
that?
No.
Another Pulitzer Prize winner.
Yeah.
But the idea being that here's a man who is setting down the historical record, and he has no psychological idea of who he is or what has transpired. Again, going back to this idea of mirrors and dichotomies sort of meshing together. Were there any literary antecedents for this, or was this just the great expanse that you had to kind of compact together in the course of actually concocting this narrative?
Well, it's interesting because I think that most people think that the urge to tell a story derives from knowledge. You know something and you want to tell somebody else about what you know.
Yeah.
I think just as often the urge to tell a story comes from not knowing something. It comes from curiosity. I think that that's the way most novelists work. the impetus for almost all of my novels is knowing something, but not knowing the thing that I most need to know in order to tell the story. But also, I think it comes, and the two examples in my fiction that are the most obvious examples of a person desperately needing to tell a story without knowing what the meaning of that story is Lucy, in this novel, desperately wanting to tell the story, his story of his family, of his town, of his relationship with Sarah, his marriage. But there are all sorts of things in that story that he either doesn't know or is shying away from because he's scared of it. The other example is a story of mine called The Horrors Child, which is a story of an 82-year-old nun who comes into a creative writing class desperately wanting to tell the story of how she became a nun and how she was sent into the convent as a child. But she herself does not know the meaning of the story. She doesn't know why she was sent to this convent. And she blames her mother for it, and it never occurs to her that the reason that she has been sent there is her father. And by the time she finishes telling the story to the class, everyone knows her secret but her. Mm-hmm. And it's a tragic, terrible, terrible story. But that's the way I think the story. Urge to tell stories works, especially first-person narration. Very often, Lucy is an unreliable narrator. Well, there are all kinds of unreliable narrators that are antecedents in American history, starting certainly with Poe, or maybe with Charles Brockden Brown, but there are all these people telling stories, and then Henry James, the governess in The Turn of the Screw, wanting to tell her story about how evil these children are. And you cannot come to the end of that story without kind of scratching your head and saying, is that where the evil really is, or is there some terrible repression in this young woman? So I think, those are the literary antecedents for this kind of story, as a person, a writer, desperately wanting to tell everybody, beware, beware, beware. You know, the ancient mariner who's got the man by the collar saying, beware. You know, listen to my story. I have a story to tell you. It'll save you.
Yeah.
But they don't know what the story means.
How much did you keep yourself in the dark when writing Bridge of Sighs? Because obviously you didn't know everything.
No, fortunately, I'm not the sort of person who ever has to keep myself in the dark. I'm there quite naturally.
But I mean this idea though of writing in a specific unknown, of the unknown being a sort of galvanizing point towards actually concocting the narrative.
Yeah. For me, that's the thrill, more than anything else. The surprise of a given scene. My favorite scene in this novel is a scene in which Lucy has one of his spells, and he does it when he's looking at one of his wife's paintings. She is painting another version of the Bridge of Sighs. And he goes in and he sits there alone and he feels himself, when his spells come on, he always has some vague sort of aura around it that tells him that he might be having a spell. And he imagines that he is inside her painting, walking along in the Bridge of Sighs. And he gets halfway across the bridge and there is his father waiting for him, long dead. Well, when I knew he was going to have a spell and I knew he was going to imagine himself in his wife's painting, and that he would get halfway across the Bridge of Sighs and that her voice would call him back. But I had no idea he was going to meet his beloved father there.
Yeah.
And so when that happened, I just had one of those great aha moments that as a writer you kill for. You know, it's so thrilling to realize that you knew something in some other part of your brain that you don't have access to every day, and that it has come forward into the front of your brain where you now have access to it. It's just why we do it. It's why we tell stories.
Yeah. Well, this must be a real challenge of a book like this, because you have so many characters, so much topography, so many stores and supporting people and the like, that it's sometimes when you're filling in the details, or maybe it seems to me when reading this, I kept reading this, it was like all these characters were propagating from the book. So maybe is it a case of you being a natural propagator so that there are no limits for you, even when you sort of spread your wings like that?
Well, I think it's more like what Noonan describes in one section of the book. He describes the freedom that comes within the borders of canvas. And for him, he thinks that that's the direct result of habit, of routine. He's talking about the fact that late in life now he's having these night terrors, and when he wakes up in the middle of the night or to keep from falling asleep, he actually walks through the five sestieres of Venice, one after another, always the same route every night, judging space by time and time by space, and it reminds him of his father and Lucy's father, who are both route men, doing the same route every day. And it's habit, it's routine, it's a rut, but it's a very purposeful rut for him. He says that routine is what allows for freedom within the canvas. And for me, it works the same way. Sitting down to either my desk or my chair in the restaurant where I go to work every morning, it's habit, it's routine. Skipping a day, not writing a day, makes the next day's work that much more difficult, and it allows for that, what we talk of, it's an inspiration, and none of us knows what it is. But inspiration, strangely enough, comes from doing things the same way every day. It comes from routine. It comes from habit. That's what opens the door to that thing that you don't know that comes. So to my mind, it's not some sort of overarching freedom of thought. It's not being a free thinker. It's doing the same thing every day. It's the routine of it that allows that spark to come.
Gotcha. There's one thing we haven't even touched upon, and that is the violence in this book.
Yeah, there's
a considerable amount of it. But one of the interesting things is that one of the major fights, the fight outside the movie theater, has one of the participants actually, we learn later that he has gone and become a professor. And that to me sort of said something that no matter what particular class or socioeconomic strata you escape to, you are always, violence is a starting point in some sense. So, I mean, there's more violence in this than many of your other books. So
yes, there is.
I'm wondering why this town, was it just really the kind of clash between the west side and the east side? Or?
Well, it had something to do with that, certainly. The fight you are talking about takes place between a kind of a bully white kid and a black boy who never raises his fists. He just takes a terrible, terrible beating because he won't do what this white kid wants him to do. And there is a fair amount of violence in this book, and I think it does come from the sociological aspects of the town itself. It happens when kids from the West End cross over into the East End where they're not supposed to be, or when a black kid sits with a white girl in the theater. Those are the impulses for it. But it also, I mean, Lucy is the main character is victimized early on by a group of bullies, and it's not. No violence takes place, but it's threatened and it's terrifying. And what interests me is the effect of violence on these people's lives, because the same thing happened to Noonan. Noonan too, like Lucy, was locked in that trunk, but it didn't affect him in the same way. And Perry, the boy who administers that terrible beating to the black boy, ends up going on to become a college professor, although I think it's interesting that when he comes back home, he gets in a pickup basketball game with one of the school vice principals and breaks his nose with a flying elbow. Yeah. So I think at the level of impulse.
Again, elbows.
Yeah. I think at the level of impulse, we all have the potential for impulse within us that can be triggered in various ways. And in the case of Perry Kozlowski, he probably hasn't offered to violence to anybody in a very long time after he's become a professor. But the impulse is still there. You can change your behavior, but you can't change your impulses.
Yeah. even the violence that affects Noonan at the end, this sort of really preposterous gash and then all of a sudden everybody's talking about this, like, what did you do? And again, I'm trying not to give away the book.
Yeah.
But I mean, the violence in this works in tandem with how the town observes the violence. Like in the case of this fight outside the movie theater, it's almost a Kitty Genovese effect.
Right.
Nobody does anything. And in fact, Tessa is extremely shocked about this whole thing.
Right.
So, I mean, is this more of a kind of way of, I guess, commenting upon what violence is like in America? How no matter where you go in the course of American history, people are just not going to really do a damn thing. They're just going to let violence unleash like this.
Right. I mean, one of the literary antecedents, I suppose, of this, one of the writers that I thought about a lot in the writing of this book was Twain. And you see it in things like the face of the fence painting scene is it reminds you of Tom Sawyer certainly, but also in Huckleberry Finn, which is also an incredibly violent novel, I think, but it's violent in there the violence, as here, is connected to ignorance. It's connected to it's just very American.
Yeah.
You know, the way it breaks out, and I was interested in this book in dealing with violence in that same way that Twain did. It's very matter of fact. Its origins are usually pretty clear. I mean, you know what's going to happen. You just watch the novel play out with a sense of dread between Bobby and his father. You just know they're headed to a very violent place.
Yeah.
And it's withheld, but you know it's coming, and you know why it's coming. And so I was interested, I think, as both a psychologist and a sociologist, about violence in America, where it seems to come from, what its after effects are. This was something I knew I was going to be playing around with in this book.
Well, there's also the other character, Mr. Berg, is quite an eccentric. In fact, I was reading this going, how could this guy continue to teach an honors English class, no less?
Yeah.
And yet he's just saying the most remarkable things. But then it occurred to me, oh, well, this is my stupid urbanism kind of kicking in.
Yeah.
And in a small town, they don't have anybody else. Did you experience a teacher along these lines, or what happened? Why did this really crazy sort of intellectual appear to be the sort of major teacher of the town?
Well, that's one of the things about small towns and small schools, is that eccentrics are much more likely to find a place in a smaller environment than in a larger one. I look back, it seems to me that at least half my teachers were teetering on the brink of insanity, and half of those were nuns. So looking for a crazy teacher, I don't think you have to, anybody in America probably has to look very far to find an absolutely unhinged, sometimes brilliantly unhinged mind that they've encountered in some time. I always think of Charles Baxter wrote a wonderful story called Griffin, about an absolutely lunatic teacher, and it's one of the best stories I think ever written about a crazy teacher.
Gotcha.
Have a look at that sometime.
I haven't read that. Actually, I wanted to ask you really quickly about Gabriel Machen, The Howling. How The Howling came to be. Why did this man need to howl?
I don't know where The Howling came from, actually. It was just a word that was kind of there. I wanted Gabriel to befriend Lucy, and I wanted him at one point to try to explain his own howling, and he does. He says he's driven to it. He says, well, we won't use the word that he says is the reason for it, but I think it's a feature of his despair. This is a novel about despair, among other things, and I think that Gabriel uses alcohol to deal with the fact that he paints this fence around the house of a man who once owned slaves. I mean, that's his job. I mean, how dispiriting is that, to be a black man painting the fence of a rich Tory who once held slaves on the ground, on the grounds. I mean, and he's lost his wife and he's lost his kid.
Yeah. And also, you know, outside the bar, he's prohibited from going in there as
that's
well.
Right.
And
that's
so
right.
there's this aspect too. And he's, and in fact, to a certain degree, the people inside the bar howl back at him when
he's
asking, you know, in fact, and by the way, what was up with the gizzards in this book?
Such a wonderful word, isn't it?
Half the characters were talking about gizzards in some manner. So
that's true. It's an impulse that most novelists contain, isn't it? The impulse to use the word gizzard. Most novelists are able to restrain themselves.
Yeah.
Faced with the word gizzard, they restrain themselves and they manage to write sometimes an entire novel without using that word.
Yeah. So really the best way to capture working class life is to use gizzard.
Just find a way and you're halfway there.
Okay. Well, I know you got to go, but Rick, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
It was an adventure getting here, but once we got here, we had fun. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.